Hey, deserving listeners, this is chapter 4 in my deep dive on schizotypal personality disorder. I wanted to start out this chapter by going to the internet and reading what the internet says about schizotypal personality disorder, because often with personality disorders and with schizotypal, there are very insufficient descriptions. And I think this is a major barrier to not only lay people understanding what that is, but also to clinicians. You know, clinicians go to the internet. They don't have some special place. I mean, hopefully they have other avenues to find out clinical information, you know, publications, supervisors, colleagues, trainings, graduate school. But a lot of clinicians, in my experience, they just go to the internet as well. So I thought I would read what the internet has to say. And the main website we think of when we think of medical and mental health issues, I think, or one of the main ones, is WebMD. Of course, this is the website that you go to when you have some sort of physical symptom and you read what you might have, and then you start freaking out. So let's read schizotypal personality disorder on WebMD. All right, so it says, what is schizotypal personality disorder? Schizotypal personality disorder is one of a group of conditions informally called eccentric personality disorders. People who have these disorders often seem odd or peculiar to others. They also may show unusual thinking patterns and behaviors. All right, just chiming in here. Yeah, this is, I would say, 75% of the time, anecdotally, on the internet, when someone is officially talking about schizotypal, they will identify that it's a cluster A personality disorder. And I find this to be mildly interesting, but it, I think, points people in the wrong direction. It's overly simplistic. The whole clustering of the personality disorders I find to be strange anyway. I could go into a long string of that, but there's something wrong here on WebMD, but it just emphasizes something that I wouldn't personally emphasize. The other thing is that it basically says that associates eccentricity to these three personality disorders, meaning that anyone who's eccentric might have this, and or anyone who has this must be eccentric, because it's not exactly true, right? It's an oversimplification. It's just something I just wouldn't say up front. It's too simplistic. All right, going on. What are personality disorders? Okay, this has got to be interesting. People with personality disorders have longstanding patterns of thinking and acting that differ from what society considers usual or normal. Their rigid personality traits can cause problems and interfere with many areas of life, including social and work. People with significant personality disorders generally have poor coping skills and trouble forming healthy relationships. All right, just going chiming in here. Yeah, I mean, how do you describe personality disorders in a paragraph on WebMD that is supposed to be understood by everyone, or at least the vast majority of people in the English-speaking world in the internet? It's a tall order. I have graduate students. I know people in my field, people that are practicing, even professors, to be honest with you, who don't understand what a personality disorder is, or they sort of get it, but not sufficiently in my book. So, it's a tall order. I guess if I were the author of this page, I might have just written like, okay, it says, what are personality disorders? And then I would just have one sentence that says, there's no possible way that I can explain to you in this short form what a personality disorder is. So just live with the fact that you won't understand what it is. Now, having said that, let's look at their explanation here. It's, again, it's not wrong. It's just hard to imagine anyone reading this without any sort of additional information, understanding what they're reading, right? So people with personality disorders have longstanding patterns of thinking and acting that differ from what society considers usual or normal. People with personality disorders have longstanding patterns, okay, longstanding patterns, I would say forever pattern, really, of unless they get treated, of thinking and acting, okay, that differ from what society considers usual or normal. So that really encapsulates a lot of things, right? It encapsulates way more than a personality disorder, right? Going on, their rigid personality traits can cause problems and interfere with many areas of life. Yeah. People with significant personality disorders generally have poor coping skills and trouble forming healthy relationships. Okay. Unlike people with anxiety disorders, who know that they have a problem but can't control it. People with personality disorders are often not aware that they have a problem and do not believe that they have anything to control. Just chiming in here, that last bit is perhaps the best bit in this article. It's not always the case, of course, but it is a central feature that could differentiate personality disorders from other kinds of things. All right, next paragraph here. Schizotypal personality disorder symptoms. People with schizotypal personality disorder have odd behavior. Yeah, I mean, it just basically just reads them there. There's no sense of me repeating that, so that looks all good there. Next paragraph, schizotypal personality disorder versus schizophrenia. Okay, this is going to be interesting. People with schizotypal personality disorder may have odd beliefs or superstitions. Okay, they have trouble forming close relationships and tend to distort reality. Okay, distort reality. What is that? How would anyone understand what that meant? In this way, schizotypal personality disorder can seem like a mild form of schizophrenia, a serious brain disorder that distorts the way a person thinks, acts, expresses emotions, perceives reality, and relates to others. Okay, it identifies it as a serious brain disorder, which is interesting. I think that our current science isn't advanced enough to delineate between these things, but I wonder if in 50 years, once we do have that technology, if that essentially will be found, not in a simplistic way like that, but I don't know, I've already gone over that. People who have schizophrenia are disconnected from reality. They may have delusions and see or hear things that aren't there, but people who have schizotypal personality disorder don't. In rare cases, people with schizotypal personality disorder may go on to develop schizophrenia. Okay, I mean, that's a good summary. It's not horrible, but it depends on people understanding what schizophrenia is, and you know. But let's read this first sentence. People with schizotypal personality disorder may have odd beliefs or superstitions. Yeah, okay. But again, how do you differentiate someone with schizotypal versus someone that just has a regular, quote-unquote, odd belief? How do you know that you're not just identifying it as an odd belief when it's not an actual schizotypal sort of odd belief? You know, it is something of an art form determining that. It takes a experienced clinician to delineate that. And we don't just go off of just odd beliefs that someone might have. We will take in a lot of other data to justify the label of schizotypal. For instance, if I met someone in my office and I was assessing them and they had an odd belief, like they, you know, what's it kind of a in the zone of schizotypal? Let's say that they believe that their trees can talk to them. The trees on their property around their house can talk to them. That's not a common superstition, right? They're, you know, more common superstitions are believing in ghosts or other kinds of things like that. So, believing that you can't walk under ladders, that kind of stuff, or you shouldn't walk on a crack. You know, these aren't exactly scientific facts, but they're terribly not scientific facts, but they are common, and it's not common, at least to me. I don't know if I haven't heard of this before, other than people with schizotypal having this, that they believe that the trees are trying to tell them something. And so if I met someone that had that belief, if someone told me that belief, I'm trying to imagine what I would think. And yeah, I mean, it would be a red flag for schizotypal, but I wouldn't be like, oh my God, schizotypal. I would really need to hear a lot more data to justify even going down a road of investigating it. All right, going on here. Schizotypal personality disorder causes. Okay, this is going to be interesting. Your genes may play a role in schizotypal. Okay, that's good. It's more common in relatives of people with schizophrenia and usually starts in early adulthood. Okay, good. A person's temperament, reactions to life events. A person's temperament, reactions to life events, relationships, and coping strategies probably all have something to do with how their personality develops during childhood and adolescence. Actually, I really like that summary. It steers away from ridiculous claims. It says your genes may play a role. It's more common with people that have relatives with schizophrenia or schizotypal for that matter. And you know, temperament, life events, reactions to the life events, relationships, coping strategies might all contribute to how a personality is developing. Yeah, I actually kind of like this article in that they seem to have a similar belief in the delineation between pre-schizophrenia and schizotypal personality disorder. Anyway, next paragraph. Schizotypal personality disorder diagnosis. If you have symptoms, your doctor, and that's probably boring, just tells you to go to the physician. Schizotypal personality disorder treatment. All right, let's read this. People with schizotypal personality disorder rarely get treatment for the disorder itself. Just chiming in here. Yeah, that's very true. Going on, when they do go to the doctor, it's often for a related disorder such as depression or anxiety. That's also very true. All right, so they go through different forms of psychotherapy that they say that it may include. Psychotherapy may include cognitive behavioral therapy, sure. Supportive therapy, yeah. Supportive expressive therapy, let's see their description of this. This helps you get rid of negative biases about relationships. You'll open up about your thoughts, feelings, and concerns, okay. And family therapy, treatment works best when family members are involved and supportive, yeah. Yeah, this doesn't, that's the end of the list. That doesn't include what I do with people. But it said, you know, psychotherapy may include, which is fine. And then it talks about medication, lifestyle management, and yeah. Oh, let's talk about complications. Schizotypal personality disorder complications. People with this disorder might be more likely to have anxiety or depression, yeah. They also, but it doesn't say why. It should say because the condition of the personality disorder can be quite debilitating and can isolate you, so you have reasons to be anxious and depressed. They also tend to have poor social skills and lack fulfilling relationships. Yeah, without treatment, people with this disorder can become even more uncomfortable in social situations, which can lead to further isolation. Yeah, that's all true. All right, well, you know, what grade do I give this webpage? I've never graded a webpage. I mean, it's an A for, I'd give it an A for what it's setting out to do. It's trying to briefly summarize in the WebMD manner something that's quite complicated. I'd give it definitely above average grade overall, independent of the format, because it is in, there's nothing on this page where I'm just like, whoa, because there is usually, I guess I just randomly picked a web page that is at least in the right headspace as they write this. You know, there's a lot of bad information out there. So yeah, maybe on the internet, schizotypal doesn't have a lot of misinformation, but I will say that the depth of the explanations are not sufficient. I looked around a lot on the internet, various different YouTube videos and other kinds of things, and really the only videos that I thought explained it well were actual people with the disorder describing what it was like to have it. And these videos tend not to get very many views, but I find these are the only things on the internet or posts on Reddit where people are talking about what it's like to have it. When clinicians talk about it, they just tend to talk about what they see. They tend to talk about what they see and what's in the DSM, which is a starting point for sure, but doesn't really explain what it's like. So anyway, so the rest of this chapter, I'm going to go into more depth. I'm going to continue doing that, but this episode is just for patrons of the podcast. So if you want to hear the rest of this, you have to be a patron of the podcast by going to patreon.com. When you become a patron, you get access to this episode and all the other chapters in this deep dive and all the other deep dives that I've done over the past 14 years. So do it now if you want to. Otherwise, please take care of yourself because you deserve it. You really, really, really do. Hey, deserving listeners, this is chapter 4 in my deep dive on schizotypal personality disorder. Let's just get right into it. So these are descriptions of people online who have been submitting their stories, their experiences of schizotypal. They claim they have schizotypal, and this is their experience of it. I want to remind everyone that these individuals are being brave for putting their stories out there, and they are, suffering quite a bit in all likelihood. All right, so let's read this. This individual says, I think I speak in a rather unusual manner. I speak in a rather unusual manner. I tend to use a mixture of very formal, educated language. I use a fair bit of British slang, despite not being British. And when I'm tired, I tend to speak in a more formal way rather than a less formal way like most people do. End of description. Yeah, this is a pretty classic presentation. Not everyone with schizotypal has this. Obviously, you know, it'd be a minority, but it is a common enough experience that I've heard it before, where people with schizotypal, in terms of that symptom of odd speech, it will manifest as them speaking in very formal ways, and maybe even speaking in a different accent or using slang from a different culture. All right, this next description, individual says, my symptoms are the following. I believe I am being guided by numbers. I see faces in almost everything. Just chiming in here. Pretty common type of symptom, the magical thinking, the odd perceptions going on here. When I use the toilet, I feel like the people are watching me in shame and disgust. I feel naked when in front of a crowd. Just chiming in. This is classic paranoia. Continuing. I'm working on managing my symptoms by trying to change the pattern of how I think and ignore how I feel inside. End of description. Yeah, so that is one approach to managing the symptoms, is to try to differentiate and look at the interpretation and say, no, that's not actually what's happening. People aren't out to get me. Going on with another description here. I think my disorder is largely genetic. My paternal grandfather was schizophrenic, but also my parents divorced when I was young, and my mother is a nightmare. I can't handle relationships with people because I am too paranoid that everyone dislikes me. I assume everyone thinks I'm strange, and they can tell that there's something wrong with me. I also assume people want to harm me. I read people's facial expressions as more hostile than they are. For example, a neutral face will appear overtly hostile or disapproving, making me intensely uncomfortable. After a lifetime of my skin crawling in intimate situations, I no longer desire relationships. Just chiming in here. So you can hear the difference, at least I can, between what we might call in the area of avoidant personality disorder. These individuals also will walk around thinking that everyone is thinking bad thoughts about them, but it's based on a schema that for the avoidant personality person, they believe there is something deeply flawed about them. It's much more akin to dependent personality disorder in that way. Whereas people with schizotypal, they believe everyone is looking at them funny and judging them, not because there's a viable reason to do so, but because other people are evil. Other people have hostile, unfair intent in the world, particularly towards them, right? So it's a pretty big distinction going on here. I have really bad anhedonia, which causes me to spend most of my time basically doing nothing because nothing feels good. Because of this, I'm compulsive about things that reliably do feel good, like masturbating, eating food, and using drugs. Just chiming in here. So yeah, what can happen, the anhedonia or the lack of feeling can generate not only from the schizotypal itself, in that the individual could have really constricted emotions. The emotions are down there, but they just don't really feel them. So there's that. But also, when you go through life completely cut off from other people and are being unfair, you feel like you're being unfairly judged and there's a lot of stress, then you can become depressed, and thus you can have a numbness of feeling. Also, what we're hearing here is the individual is compulsive about masturbation, eating food, and using drugs. This is common for a lot of people, but people with schizotypal as well, as a way of trying to cope with the isolation and the stress. It's a routine, it's a ritual you can go through. There's also some amount of euphoria that can happen from this going on here. I frequently have the sense that I am somehow more in touch with the rules of reality than other people. I believe that trees are sentient and wish to communicate with me, but I'm not very good at understanding them. I can tell when it's going to rain, for example, by the sound of the trees around my house. I sometimes get the powerful belief that a particular tree is feeling a certain type of way about me, often negative. They don't audibly speak, but I can sense that they would like to. End of description. So yeah, so that last bit is just a classic example of schizotypal magical thinking and odd perception, that it's in the direction of an hallucination, but not full blown. the trees want to speak to him or them. The trees are thinking things. There's a possibility of hearing what the trees are saying, but the individual can't actually hear or can't actually speak with the trees. It's in the direction of a delusion, but not a full-blown experience of a delusion. Another person here, I have a mild case of schizotypal personality disorder. These are the most prominent symptoms, which are often provoked by mild stress. Occasionally, feeling presence of a dark figure watching me from behind. Seeing shadow figures which are threatening. Perceptual disturbances like walls that are moving, water is burning me. I even saw a hand coming out of my cabinet once, etc. Yeah, so this is pretty classic schizotypal. Not everyone with schizotypal has this, but very common experiences. This individual saying, you know, that they feel a presence of a dark figure watching them, you know, shadowy figures that are threatening them, that kind of thing. Sometimes being suspicious, I'm sometimes suspicious of my flatmates, thinking they are searching my room or planning things behind my back, feeling everything and everyone are out to get me. Again, just classic paranoia. And I also have an absence of feelings. All right, just going on here with another description. I think I have a bit of the paranoia-ish ideation, but it mainly centers around the idea that other people are brainwashed and I possess special truths. I have fears of negative appraisal from others. I also have scopophobia, which is an excessive fear at being stared at. I invest little energy into sustaining interpersonal relationships. I don't really experience happy or pleasurable states. I have depersonalization and derealization. Also, memories seem to lack an emotional or embodied dimension, making them appear flat or surreal. Another description here. I feel like my behavior is affected by numbers, like odds are good and evens are bad, and 444s and 666s are really bad. I had an insane amount of paranoia about others, like people putting cameras in my room and were watching my every move. I felt others could read my mind, like I was just a robot experiment, and every action I did was so obvious, and they knew exactly what I was thinking. All right, just chiming in here. So this is starting to sound more in the camp of mild schizophrenia. They might qualify for schizotypal personality disorder, but hearing this, it's starting to sound more in the direction of mild, how I would conceptualize, or at least the more mild schizophrenic version of schizotypal, if you know what I'm saying. Another going on. I feel like my actions have been overly eager, so I respond with an overly dull response to compensate. I feel like I'm being affected by something out of this world, like supernatural, feeling like people have a spirit around them, giving them an aura that I sense, a feeling of people around me having no faces, a tingle in my neck when I feel presence of something that is not actually there. Things have gotten a lot better since I've quit smoking weed and doing drugs. Also, therapy, medication, and school has definitely helped me. End of description. Yeah, that one, hard to know. You know, I'll take their word for it that it's schizotypal or that they qualify, but I wasn't hearing any of the classic schema about other people being out to get them, that kind of, I mean, maybe there's a little bit of that there. Maybe if I heard more, I would have been more convinced that they were solidly, at least in the camp that I consider to be the personality sort of version of this. Another description. I'm really into aliens, UFOs, and clairvoyance. I believe my mood affects the movement of the trees and the weather. I can tell the future. If I pray for something, it'll come true, despite the fact that I'm not religious. My dreams are signs of things to come. Sometimes I believe that songs on the radio are especially for me. Just chiming in here. Yeah, pretty classic schizotypal going on. I often feel others are plotting to make me not succeed. For example, in college, groups would work against me, even my own teammates, or that women have a grudge against me. Just chiming in here. Yeah, so when you have the UFOs and the aliens and the mood affecting the trees matched up with this very specific version of paranoia around other people around them plotting against them, then we're definitely, in my book, in the camp of the conceptualization of the personality sort of version of schizotypal going on here. I hardly show emotions and sometimes show the opposite expected emotion. I lack close friends. I have strange speech. Sometimes my sentences won't make sense and I use strange metaphors and stuff, supposedly. I dress strangely. For example, I wear very bizarre patterned or floral shirts and patterned socks that don't match. All right, just one more anonymous description here. I recently came across this disorder after taking a test for personality disorders, and I got this. The more I read about this disorder, the more I related to it. So I'm trying to learn more about it before I go tell my doctor about it. But here are some of my possible symptoms. All right, just chiming in here. So this individual took a test online, and they seem to think they might have it, and they plan on getting assessed by a clinician in the future. So it might be framed as schizotypal, it might not be going on. Friends don't last very long due to my nature of not trusting people, and I believe they are talking behind my back. I keep having this recurring feeling that my mood affects the weather. I also feel like I have this insanely close connection with animals, and that they are trying to show me that I am not alone, and that they are here with me. So just chiming in here. So I hope you can hear the child analogies to these magical thoughts, these odd perceptions that these individuals have. Not all the time, but often, and again, it's that question that I was asking in the previous chapter about, would it seem more likely or more normal, more typical if you heard this report from a three-year-old or a two-year-old, that they believed that their mood affected the weather, that they feel insanely close and connected to animals, and that they're trying to tell you something, like you're not alone. Like, if you heard a two-year-old, three-year-old say that, you'd be like, oh, you know, they have an imagination, it's fine. You know, it's totally normal kinds of imagination you'll hear from a kid. And it's my conceptualization that the personality sort of version of schizotypal is that magical thinking is retained because they aren't allowed an opportunity to learn about the difference between reality and imagination from people around them because they're being neglected or abused. And they lean into that magical thinking because it's a solace. And you could absolutely imagine this individual having part of their personality is there to help them, right? To say like, look, you know, so... For me, I'll just talk about for me. When I'm feeling down, there's a part of me, you could say, that is trying to pick me up. That's trying to say, hey, you're a good person. You have worth. People like you or something like that. And I don't frame it as animals that are telling me this or that the weather or God is telling me this. I frame it as a part of myself. I might even frame it as an internalization from my parents or something, you know, an interject of some sort. Whereas for children and for undifferentiated people, they might take it a big step further, which is this sense that they get that someone is trying to tell them that they're good enough isn't just a part of themselves or an interjected part of someone else, but literally animals or trees around me are trying to tell me this. It's that lack of differentiation between self and the world where you start to think that the whole world revolves around you, not in a narcissistic way, but in a childish way going on. When I smoke, I think marijuana, I sense that there's another entity in the room with me sitting in the chair in the corner. I've also been told that when the things I say and the way I say it is very peculiar. I also have intense mood swings throughout the day without warning. So end of description. So, you know, I think that these descriptions are very helpful, I think, and I'm really glad that these anonymous individuals put it out there. All right, so let's switch gears for a second and talk about what some people will term as happy schizotypes or schizotypes. So these individuals have just the positive side of schizotypal and not the negative. So they will claim or they will report that they experience the magical thinking, the odd perceptions, the ideas of reference, but not in a persecutory way. And they have eccentric thinking and behavior without the negative side. So if you have a magical thought that you're in connection with nature and you can commune with the animals, that doesn't necessarily mean that it will create any sort of dysfunction, right? You could have an odd perception, like you can see people's auras or you could feel music or something like this and not have it interfere with your life. It might just be a fun experience, right? You could have an idea of reference or lots of ideas of reference, meaning that a lot of things have to do with you, like the weather is actually trying to tell you something or the TV newscaster is trying to tell you something. But as long as it doesn't blossom into something destructive to you or other people, then it could either just be a neutral thing or even a positive thing. You know, it could be a way of building meaning in your life or purpose, this sort of thing. You could be very, very eccentric in the way that you dress or the way that you think or the way that you talk. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it would be a bad thing, right? Now, there are some inherent bad or negative destructive symptoms in people's lives, like the fact of having no emotions or weird emotions, emotions that are off-putting even to you, right? Or having anhedonia, the inability to feel pleasure, or being socially isolated, being uninterested in socializing with others. So you could perhaps have not have those things, right? You could have the interesting, neutral, and positive aspects of schizotypal, but not the negative. Now, it's found that seemingly this version of schizotypal, now, technically speaking, you wouldn't qualify as schizotypal because it's not interfering with your life. So you have, say, some of the traits. It's sort of like with me. I have some of the traits of obsessive compulsive personality disorder. But I would argue that a lot of my traits of this quote-unquote disorder is it enhances my life. Perfectionism and drive and conscientiousness, planning ahead, being very careful, being very responsible is something that I actually benefit from. I enjoy it. People around me benefit. My wife will, you know, it's one of the things that she'll compliment me. You know, if you ever have those surveys, like, you know, what do you like about your partner the most? My wife will often, you know, near the top of the list will be that I'm extremely dependable, that she can count on me in all the ways that one would hope you can count on your partner. So the conscientiousness, the obsessive compulsive aspects of myself can be a good thing. Can it be a bad thing for me? Yeah, and I've been over that quite extensively. But for a schizotypal, it's a similar thing. You could have the fun, eccentric, creative, magical parts of it without it being negative, but you wouldn't technically qualify for the disorder. You'd just be, it would have traits and none of the bad traits. So according to some, this good version of schizotypal is associated with functioning relatively well, feeling relatively happy most of the time, higher creativity, higher enjoyment of creative activities, higher openness to experience. However, I will say that I know people like this, or I might characterize them as this, conceptualize them this way. And I will say that they're not always easy to be friends with. There are positive aspects of these individuals, like, oh my God, they're so interesting, or they're so dynamic, or they're so creative, or they're fun to create with, or they have enthusiasm for life. They think outside the box. They help me think outside. You know, there's a lot of different benefits to having a friend like this or a loved one. But in my experience, this is just anecdotal. They can be flighty at times. They can also rigidly adhere to some odd beliefs, you know, and if you don't believe in them as well, they could take offense to that, right? Because their magical world includes X, Y, and Z, and you don't adhere to that system of thinking, and so they could be insulted by that and hurt by that. You could argue that now we're starting to get into the negative side of schizotypal, and thus that's not really core to what they would call happy schizotype, but, you know, that's just my experience. And I suppose with many of the clients that I work with schizotypal who can go in this direction, this is maybe the end result of therapy, you know, that we wouldn't be necessarily looking for complete eradication or mitigation of all symptoms, but maybe selecting for certain aspects of schizotypal that the person enjoys while working on the other aspects, right? So you could have someone with schizotypal and have them retain, and maybe even purposely retain as a part of treatment, the good sides, the eccentricness, the outside the box thinking, the openness to experience, the enthusiasm for magic in the world, that kind of thing. All right, so let's talk about comorbidities or common co-occurring disorders. First, let's look at schizoid personality disorder. And as you notice, I'm landing on the pronunciation of schizoid, or I think some people will say schizoid, but when I do a deep dive on that disorder, I'll get into that mess. 33% of people with schizotypal personality disorder will qualify also for schizoid or schizoid personality disorder, according to one study. So this seems either a result of misunderstanding the two of them, or that one could have a whole set of symptoms around the area of being isolated and a loner, and thus qualify for both disorders. I would be really skeptical if I heard someone diagnosing an individual with both, in my opinion, because it, well, let's see, how would I conceptualize it? I've never diagnosed someone with both because I see them as really quite different things. When you have schizoid personality disorder, you have no motivation to be with other people. You do not want relationships. It's just you're irrelational with other people. You just don't want relationships. And if you have schizotypal, then you actually do want to be in a relationship with other people, but you avoid people as a defense because of the amount of paranoia and suspiciousness that you have of other people. And you've just learned it's just better to avoid. And you might convince yourself that you don't want to be with other people, but you really do deep down. Schizoid individuals are really quite unique. It's a rare disorder. It's common enough that it's out there, of course. But when I see someone that's isolating themselves and they're a loner, schizoid is not the first assessment route that I will take. It's one of the options available to me, but there's so many other that are, in my experience, more common. You have schizotypal, you have avoidant personality, you have, you know, just introversion, you have autistic spectrum, you have social anxiety. There's a lot of other reasons as to why someone would be a loner. But so if someone qualified for both, another clinician could make an argument that, look, schizoid people do not have magical thinking. They don't have suspiciousness of other people. So this individual does have these things and thus does qualify for schizotypal. And deep down, and I've really tried to figure out if this is just defense. And I have determined that deep down, without any sort of layered defense on top of this, this individual legitimately does not have any interest in being with other people. And they're magical. They have magical thinking and they have these thoughts that, you know, ideas of reference and they, you know. So could I see that? Yeah. I've never seen that before. Could that exist? Yeah, absolutely. And the research apparently points in that direction. Paranoid personality disorder, 60%, according to one study, Siever et al., 60% of people with schizotypal personality disorder also qualify for the diagnosis of paranoid personality disorder. So again, if I heard someone presenting a case where they're diagnosing with both, I would be skeptical because there's a lot of paranoia within schizotypal, and you would have to really demonstrate that the paranoia, there was an additional element of paranoia or something, I don't know, or that the paranoia was so particular in both ways, both the schizotypal people and a paranoid personality disorder. So, yeah, but according to some research, most people with schizotypal also qualify for paranoid. And maybe when I do my deep dive on paranoid, I'll change my mind on that. But that's just my initial thought. Avoidant personality disorder, 66% of patients with schizotypal personality qualified also for avoidant personality. Now, this I could see. These two things I actually have seen in one individual, and they do work synergistically with each other. So you could, as a result of your traumas and schemas and your biological disposition, have all the qualities of schizotypal that we've talked about and be a loner and be very suspicious but really want to be with other people. And you also believe that you're deeply flawed. So you have both. You have the avoidance of other people and also the suspiciousness of other people because you just believe other people are out to get you, and you think that there is something deeply wrong with you. You have a deep deficit in your personality or the way you look or the way you are, the way you think. You could absolutely have both of those things in one person. Borderline personality disorder, according to one study, 55% of patients with schizotypal also qualify for borderline. Again, this is dubious. Could you have both? Yeah, absolutely. They could absolutely exist, but I don't know. I'd have, if someone told me that they had someone with borderline and schizotypal, I'd have to be like, well, let's talk. Now, similar to avoidant, borderline does work, you know, synergistically with schizotypal. You, as a child, went through a lot of mistreatment and you developed schizotypal in the way that I talked about in chapter 2. And you had a lot of specific abandonment, betrayal traumas that resulted in you having very black and white thinking about other people, a lot of perceived rejection and betrayal from other people. I don't know. As I say it out loud, if someone had the magical thinking and the mild hallucinations that's really in the, you know, odd speech that's really endemic to schizotypal, if they had what I would call to be that abandonment reactivity and that betrayal reactivity, I would just frame it within schizotypal and a flavor of borderline, I guess. Because schizotypal people, given their, you know, well, let me just, maybe some of you know this already just based on what I've said, but, you know, for some borderline individuals, not all, they will see abandonment and betrayal where it doesn't exist, right? So they have a friend that doesn't text them back, and they will completely blow that, the person with borderline, with severe borderline of this type, will completely blow it out of proportion. This friend is out to get me. They're talking crap about me. They've always been a bad friend to me, and I'm going to text them back a second time and say, you're a complete jerk face. So within schizotypal, you could absolutely imagine someone with schizotypal doing that. They both generate, in my conceptualization, from the same place with rejection experiences, with rejection trauma, betrayal trauma, right? In the borderline person, it manifests in the borderline traits. And with schizotypal, it manifests in this paranoid, worry about other people's intentions toward you. Paranoid personality disorder also generates from the same place as well. So, yeah. Maybe I'll have to do, at the end of this, I'll have to do a whole episode kind of delineating between these two, and at least in my own way of seeing it, of, you know, what's the line there? And, of course, there's no definitive concrete line, but I don't know. The more I talk about it, the more I'm like, huh. Yeah. I mean, but I will say that of the people that I work with quintessential borderline, at least in the way that I see it, they don't have any of those ancillary symptoms that people with schizotypal have. They don't have that severe magical thinking. They don't have those odd perceptions. They don't have those mild hallucinations. They don't have that odd speech. They don't have that odd emotional expression. So I think that, I guess, is the main feature as I think out loud. Antisocial personality disorder is also associated with schizotypal. I didn't see a percentage in the research literature, but they are comorbid. And even any personality disorder, one study found that 83% of people with schizotypal also qualified for at least one other personality disorder. And, you know, that stands to reason given the percentages I talked about earlier. Another co-occurring disorder is just dissociation in general, any dissociative disorder, particularly depersonalization and derealization, which makes sense given people's accounts of what it feels like. Also, substance use disorder. 68%, according to one study, of people with schizotypal also have a substance use disorder. For example, one description online, an anonymous description, reads as such: I love my drink. Oh boy, I do. Only socially, though. It's actually quite therapeutic, and being drunk really helps me open up. That's what alcohol is for, I suppose. I'm pretty open-minded in regards to other drugs, and have tried quite a few. So, just chiming in here, this is someone who claims that they have schizotypal personality disorder. It's not just someone who likes to drink. So, I love my drink. Oh boy, I do. Only socially, though, it's quite therapeutic. Being drunk really helps me to open up. That's what alcohol is for, I suppose. I'm pretty open-minded in regards to other drugs and have tried quite a few. My favorite by far is mescaline because it turns off my fantasy world and allows me to connect with the world around me. It's an amazing writer's tool. A++ would take again. Another. And by the way, I don't recommend people self-medicating. I recommend people get proper treatment. Mood disorders. 68% of those with schizotypal will also qualify, according to one study, with a mood disorder. Specifically, 50% of patients with schizotypal suffer from a major depressive disorder at the time. There's also bipolar 1 and 2, dysthymia. Also, there's a higher risk of suicide, not a tremendously higher risk of suicide with schizotypal, but one study found a 1.5 times increase likelihood, which, you know, sounds alarming, but when you consider that the likelihood of attempting is fairly low to begin with, 1.5 times more likely isn't, you know, a vast increase in risk, but it's there and notable. And this makes total sense given my, you know, my experience with people with schizotypal. It's a pretty debilitating disorder, can really isolate the individual, can cause a lot of distress, a lot of embarrassment and shame. And of course, mood disorders, depression in particular, can emerge from there. Now, bipolar bipolar can also have a similar genesis with genetic disposition and trauma. Anyway, anxiety disorders, 72% of those with schizotypal also qualify for an anxiety disorder. I might also include OCD and post-traumatic stress in there. They're not technically any more qualified as anxiety disorders, but there's a lot of overlap or a lot of co-occurrence there, which makes sense when you understand what's going on. Also, eating disorders are also co-occurring fairly frequently, probably due to early childhood trauma and ADHD. It's hard to say why these are comorbid, ADHD and schizotypal, but they often are. All right, so let's talk about differentials. Let's talk about these other disorders. How do we differentiate between them? Well, in chapter one, I talked about this construct of schizotypy or schizotypy. This is a word that isn't talked about very often, but it is a word that goes back pretty far, and I'll talk about that in the history section. But schizotypy or schizotypy, and it's spelled schizo, T-Y-P-Y, T-Y-P-Y. And this term gets used in a variety of different ways. Sometimes it's used synonymously with schizotypal. So if someone says, well, I'm seeing a bit of schizotypy there, they're saying, I'm seeing a bit of schizotypal personality there. But I think more commonly in more rigorous literature, when they're using the term schizotypy or schizotypy, they're referring to a broader spectrum of disorders or experiences that include all sub-threshold psychotic symptoms. That includes schizotypal, or probably includes people with schizotypal, but also includes other non-diagnosable set of symptoms that are characterized by sub-threshold psychosis, essentially, right? All right, another important differential to consider when you are considering labeling someone schizotypal is schizophrenia itself, right? There's a fair amount of overlap, and it depends on the evaluator. But when we look at some research, we find that 40% of participants who met at least three criteria for schizotypal, they developed schizophrenia within 15 years on average. Another study found that 25% of those with schizotypal symptoms had schizophrenia 2 years later. So according to you, if you combine these two research studies, about a quarter of people who have symptoms of schizotypal at any one point, and usually we're talking teenage years, early adulthood, within a couple of years, 25% of those people will have full-blown schizophrenia. And within 15 years, almost half or 40% will eventually develop schizophrenia. So this points in the direction that I was saying earlier, which is that I believe that schizotypal personality disorder is really talking about two different things. You're talking about people that are on their way to developing schizophrenia, and you're also talking about people with a persistent personality issue that is the result of schemas as derived from relational traumas growing up. And so sometimes when you're looking at a teenager, an early adult who qualifies for schizotypal, you won't really know, in my book, what they actually have until 15 years later, or 15 years later, because if they never develop schizophrenia and they stay clearly in the camp of a personality disorder, then you were always looking at a personality disorder. But if they develop full-blown psychosis, whether it's schizophrenia or bipolar with psychosis or schizoaffective or schizophreniform, whatever, these kinds of things, then you were never, in my book, you probably weren't looking at schizotypal in the beginning. You were probably just looking at something that looked like schizotypal, looked like a personality disorder, but was in fact just mild psychosis. But let's break down the specific areas of differentiation. So one area is episodes of symptoms when it comes to schizophrenia, meaning that the symptoms are episodic and will happen every once in a while in waves, versus with a personality disorder where it's a pervasive part of one's personality. Now, is there a Venn diagram there? Yeah, might someone with schizophrenia basically have a constant level of symptoms? Sure, that can happen. It's not usual, but it can happen. And could someone with a personality disorder have episodic upwellings of more severity of their, particularly their positive symptoms in schizotypal? Yeah. But generally speaking, the people that I've treated, it's easy to differentiate on this dimension. Are the symptoms of psychosis or psychosis-like experiences episodic, or are they more consistent? And so that's just one thing to look at. Another dimension to look at is to look at whether you're observing delusions of reference in schizophrenia versus ideas of reference, which are in schizotypal. So we've talked about ideas of reference where you're watching TV and you think that it might be talking to you. Whereas a delusion of reference is, it could involve the same thing, but it's usually more elaborate and it's usually more long lasting and more intense. You know, like that example I gave, I think in the last chapter where I had a client who was listening to a CD of music, but instead was hearing a full-on half an hour speech to him from the government or aliens or something that had a lot of detail to it. Whereas another person with schizotypal might get a sense that the trees are trying to tell them something, and they don't really know what the trees are trying to tell them. And it's, you know, it's fairly, it's a vague feeling, but it, you know, it feels very real to them. So I hope you can delineate between those two different, one is a delusion, a full on delusion, psychotic break of, and a delusion of reference. And then the other one is more of an ongoing idea of reference, right? Now, another difference in this category to look at in individuals is, can you influence them in the midst of their magical thinking or their odd thinking or their thought issue? You know, you go up to the person who heard the FBI talking to him over a CD for half an hour and you say, you know, it's possible, I'm just going to throw it out there, that is not real, that you're actually hallucinating that. You know, an example of this from my practice, I had a client who heard my neighbor's dog barking. You know, I always operate from home. And so my neighbor's dog was barking and the window's open. And my client said to me, oh, hear that dog barking? That is the government speaking to the dog and the dog is sending me a message. So that is in the direction of idea of reference, right? Because the individual thinks everything is, you know, a random dog barking. They somehow work that into, it has to do with them. But the intensity and the elaborateness of the break from reality is pretty extensive and pretty quintessential schizophrenia or quintessential psychosis of some sort. Whereas an individual who is thinking that when I talked to him about the dog and I was like, well, because at this point I remember thinking with this particular client that he might be influenceable, but I didn't realize that he was becoming more symptomatic and more intensely symptomatic. And so I seem to remember that I was trying to change his mind about the dog. I was like, well, actually, I don't think the dog is directly talking to you. And there's really no mechanism that the government can actually talk to a dog, let alone telepathy-wise talk to a dog. And he didn't believe me. He didn't go with what I was saying. He was completely convinced that the dog was influenced by the government and they were talking to him. So that's more in the camp of schizophrenia, whereas when you're talking to someone with schizotypal, not always, but often they can differentiate, particularly when the symptom passes like a week or two later or something, maybe a year later. They're able to look back, like in the last chapter with the guy who thought that he was Spider-Man or he had a massive paranoia attack when he was at the ball. On his own, seemingly, he differentiated soon after and said, oh, I think I was having a thing right there. People with schizophrenia don't do that. When they're having a full-blown delusion, there's no pulling them out of it. There's no differentiating out of it. Are there exceptions? Yes. But that is just another thing to be looking at. Now, the odd thing about this is that usually when we're talking about personality disorders, we're talking about egosyntonic disorders, meaning that a hallmark of a personality disorder is that it feels right to the individual. And thus, when you try to help them differentiate, they have a really hard time. So I'm saying both. And it depends on the question and it depends on the thing. That's why it's just so hard to diagnose these kinds of things. And sometimes it's really hard to differentiate between schizophrenia and schizotypal in particular. Another dimension to look at when trying to differentiate in my book is once you conduct treatment for 6 to 12 months, the sort of treatment will point in a direction as to what you're looking at. So if you're looking at someone with latent schizophrenia or mild schizophrenia, and you do the typical mild schizophrenic treatment protocol, which is a lot of support, medication, you know, stress management, self-awareness, differentiation, that kind of thing. and you see a dramatic decrease in symptoms and you're going in a good direction, then in my book, you're looking more at mild schizophrenia, latent schizophrenia. But when you provide, say, a treatment that involved a lot of relational schema work and corrective experiences, healing from the lessons learned as a child that other people are always hostile, that other people are always worthy of suspicion, and through working through the, you know, exposure in the relationship and therapy, that the client learns, oh, I guess I can trust other people. I guess other people aren't always out to get me. And also, if the therapist provides a lot of reality testing, helping the client to learn the difference between reality and imagination, the way that parents hopefully will do to children when they're young, and maybe with schizotypal personality disordered individuals, they didn't get enough of that. So let's say you provide all that kind of corrective experience therapy and you see a reduction in symptoms, then you're, in my book, you're looking more at a personality disorder. And if you don't, if you do provide one of those treatments and you don't see a change, then maybe switching to that other mode or providing both, I suppose. But to me, you know, it's not the best way of assessing, but if you don't have any other way of figuring something out, or you're really trying to zero in, then you could just start providing treatment and see if it works. Okay, so that's schizophrenia. Now let's look at autism, which is another disorder that is often misunderstood with schizotypal personality disorder. Schizotypal personality disorder and autism spectrum look very similar, particularly in younger people. And it's generally accepted, though, that we're not supposed to diagnose both things in one person, because history has shown that people will often diagnose someone with both, but they are mistaking that they have both when they really just have one. Again, mainly kids. So it's generally considered bad clinical assessing to diagnose someone with both schizotypal and autism spectrum. And really, to me, they're very different, particularly once you get to know the individuals, similar to bipolar and borderline. Once you get to know the individual, it's pretty clear which one you're looking at, especially if you really understand both disorders, which isn't necessarily always true with clinicians. So some differences to look at, and this is just a real rough guide. It obviously isn't comprehensive and doesn't really encapsulate the vibe. The only way to diagnose people with any personality disorder, or diagnose anyone with autism, for example, is to have hundreds of hours of experience working with this population. Only after then are you competent, in my mind, to diagnose people with these conditions. Because you just have to see it in action. You have to see the way that all the different ways that people react. And you can't read it in a book or watch a YouTube video or listen to a deep dive, for that matter, and be able to diagnose people with it. So, but here are some areas to look at when you're trying to differentiate between schizotypal and autism. So people with autism spectrum will hyper-focus on specific things, not always, but usually, and people with schizotypal will not. People with autism spectrum will have repetitive behavior, and if you have ever hung out with someone with autism spectrum, you will see that, whereas people with schizotypal will have odd behavior that's not necessarily repetitive. People with autism spectrum might have reduced imagination, whereas people with schizotypal will have very complex social imagination, very vivid fantasy life, very rich imagination. People with autism spectrum, generally speaking, are very literal, meaning they have a hard time understanding the nuances in communication or in concepts. Whereas people with schizotypal do have the ability to understand that in all likelihood, and also insert a lot of meaning into a lot of things. There's a lot of magicalness in the world, right? Not always, but you know, it's just one of the things to look at. People with autism spectrum might have underinterpretation of others' intentions, meaning that, again, they don't read into people's behavior. They look very literally at people's behavior. Whereas people with schizotypal are over-interpreting other people's behavior. They're reading too much into other people's behavior. People with autism spectrum have a need for routine often, not always, but often, whereas people with schizotypal do not. Okay, another thing to differentiate, aside from schizophrenia and autism, is just general stress, particularly adolescent stress. When people are stressed out, kids, teenagers, young adults, they can start to exhibit these kinds of symptoms. They could start to act strange. They could start to think strange or speak strange. They could have some paranoia about other people. You know, it's not terribly uncommon to have a teenager that is having a rough time at school who believes that everyone's against them, right? And might even say things like that. They might have a lot of ideas of reference where they believe that their favorite musical artist is singing a song just to them. So is this a stable personality disorder is the thing? Is it something that is endemic to their personality and will it last over time? Or is it just a result of their stress or the perspective that they're adopting in the moment, that kind of thing? So that's important to differentiate. And sometimes it just takes time. You just have to wait it out. I've treated kids, teens, where I wasn't sure, and sometimes I don't have enough time with the individual to ever find out. I just have to go, well, you know, could be a long-standing personality disorder, could just be the stress they're under, could be this weird way that they talk. I don't really know. Another thing to differentiate is what we call a personality change due to a medical condition, meaning that you could have, I don't know, like a stroke or something, I suppose, or some kind of other medical problem that affects the nervous system that could induce a temporary or even a long-standing version of schizotypal. And it isn't technically schizotypal. It's like a medically induced mild psychosis or something. Another thing to differentiate that's similar is when some people take substances to a certain degree, meth, this kind of thing, they can have a temporary bout of mild schizophrenia or mild psychosis, and that can look like schizotypal. So if you have someone in your office and they fit the criteria for schizotypal, you might just have to wait a little bit to make sure that it's not drug induced, because you know they might not reveal to you that their current symptoms are the result of chronic ongoing drug abuse. So you just have to wait. And I've run into that before. I've had clients who I might even be treating them for many months without any sign of psychosis. And then they come into one session and they're acutely psychotic. And later on, we figured out, oh, it's because they had been using cocaine or crack or meth or something. And another thing to differentiate are all the various different mood disorders and personality disorders, of which I've already been over. All right, so let's talk about the history of schizotypal. And of course, I'm condensing a lot of information into a short amount of time, but some notable moments in the development of our understanding of schizotypal, let's go back to the 1910s. So in this decade, you have early psychiatrists in Europe observing that a lot of people, some people have what we would call today schizophrenia, but back then they called dementia praecox. And they also noticed that a lot of people had a mild version of schizophrenia or a mild version of dementia praecox. Some prominent clinicians, researchers, authors of the time worth noting, you have a Swiss psychiatrist named Eugen Bleuler. He followed in Freud's footsteps, as a lot of people did back then, but ultimately found Freud to be too rigid, and Bleuler wanted to branch out. He also worked with Carl Jung, and he specialized in schizophrenia. So a lot of our the early writings were from Eugen Bleuler and colleagues on schizophrenia and mild schizophrenia. Also, another notable figure, you have Emil Kraepelin, a German psychiatrist. Some consider him to be the founder of modern psychiatry in general, because he conceptualized psychiatric disorders as being biological and genetic, which was not a dominant idea at the time. We didn't really have a lot of attention on mental disorders up until that point, but the dominant ideas were that you were weak-willed, or you had a weak mind, or you had some sort of religious corruption of some sort, like a demon or something like that. Or an emerging idea were the Freudian ideas of psychoanalytic, psychodynamic problems, the id, this sort of stuff. So this notion that you could have schizophrenia as a result of biology and genetics was not a popular idea, but Emil Kraepelin worked hard throughout his career to push forward that idea and also look into a lot of the research on it. And today, of course, those ideas are mainstream. So Emil Kraepelin, German psychiatrist, talked about a lot of disorders at the time, including schizophrenia and mild schizophrenia. So as the observations of schizophrenia started to pile up, there were a lot more observations, case study, research kind of thing. 10 years later in the 1920s, you have Ernst Kretschmer, who wrote about patients having what he called schizothymic or schizothymic temperament, but this is what we would call schizotypal personality disorder today. So Ernst Kretschmer is the first author or the first notable author who delineated a specific label for mild schizophrenia or for what we would call schizotypal today, rather than just saying it was burgeoning dementia praecox. Future authors throughout the early 20th century would also observe a mild version of schizophrenia that would remain stable over time instead of increasing in symptomology into schizophrenia. There was more research trying to distinguish between these two, between full-blown schizophrenia and mild. Okay, so let's fast forward to 1952 when DSM, the first version, was published, 1952, and schizotypal personality disorder wasn't included yet in that first version of the DSM. In fact, it wouldn't be included until the third version of DSM in 1980, published in 1980. But people with schizotypal, that we would label schizotypal today, at the time in DSM-1 language, would have been diagnosed with possibly the following three labels. One is a label that they had schizophrenic reaction simple type, and they described this as being a loner, being underfunctioning, being apathetic, and lacking of noticeable delusions or hallucinations. Although this probably was, in my book, a description of early schizophrenia, hard to know, but I think this was an early observation, an early understanding of what I would call schizotypal personality today. Two other labels that could have also been applied at the time in DSM-1 would have been paranoid personality disorder and schizoid personality disorder, because of the reasons why they seem so similar, right? So I'm guessing if I were around that time in 1952, given the way that I think today, and I was assessing someone that I thought actually had that personality disorder that lent itself to corrective experiences and was a result of early childhood relational trauma, then I'm guessing that I would label them with paranoid personality disorder, a subset of paranoid personality disorder, and not schizoid, because, again, schizoid individuals do not actually want to have interactions or connection with other people. It's a bit of a simplification. Let's just say that on the spectrum of wanting connection and attachment, schizoid individuals are on one end of the spectrum, meaning that they might have a slight interest in having relationships with other people. It's not a complete absence of that desire necessarily. Okay, so let's talk about the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Let's kind of lump this in. This is an important era in psychiatry and psychology because, and there's a lot of reasons for this, but there was a huge uptick in the interest and the funding spent on psychiatric care and research and psychological. There's a lot of our theories, a lot of our understanding of human beings and also of therapy had its genesis in the 40s, 50s, 60s. Humanistic psychology, cognitive behavioral, cognitive therapy, you could argue behavioral therapy began earlier in the century, but formalized behavioral therapy, you could argue, emerged in the 50s. Early family therapy, the development of the modern understanding of psychodynamic therapy, there's just so much that happened in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And one of the major factors is because you had a lot of military folks, thousands of military folks coming back from the war in Europe, World War II, with PTSD and various other mental issues. And so there was a lot of interest in it, a lot of funding. You have all these regular fellas who go to war and they come back with mental issues, and the government might have felt responsible. It kind of normalized mental issues as something that anyone could have, not just quote unquote crazy people. There's also a lot of developments in psychiatry, new medications. For example, the first antipsychotic was introduced in the early 1950s. So it's a very exciting time. A lot of what we understand about our field today basically began in the 1950s. Consensus emerged with researchers and clinicians around then that there were some people who had a mild version of schizophrenia, and many of those people did not develop full schizophrenia. You know, prior to this, my impression is that most clinicians either figured mild schizophrenia would develop into full schizophrenia, or they just didn't know that there was a mild version of schizophrenia. Sandor Rado was a major figure during this time. I mentioned him earlier as one of the individual who coined the term schizotype, which would change into schizotypal. He was a Hungarian psychoanalyst who worked under Freud. He emigrated to the United States in the 1930s and practiced and did all of his stuff as a professional in the United States. He coined the term schizotype as an abbreviation of the term schizophrenic phenotype, meaning looks like schizophrenia. Schizotype would later become schizotypal personality disorder later on. He studied and wrote a lot about schizotype. His model identified four core features of schizotypy, one being a mild thought disorder. So that is the magical thinking or the belief that you're Spider-Man or the belief that you can talk to trees or the belief that the TV is talking to you. Anhedonia, which is the lack of enjoying things. Ambivalence, which I'm not exactly sure what ambivalence can mean a lot of different things, but I'm not quite sure what he was referring to. I could only speculate. And then interpersonal aversiveness, meaning that the individual didn't want to hang out with other people, didn't want to interact with other people. So you could argue this is not exactly schizotypal, what Sandor Rado was describing. But what I think he did, which was very important, was he popularized a term upon which our field could start to investigate this personality disorder and this version of mild schizophrenia. Another important figure in our understanding of schizotypal is Paul Meehl, who was an American psychologist and professor at the University of Minnesota in the mid-20th century. He was elected president of the American Psychological Association, and he was very influential in the study of a lot of things, including schizophrenia and schizotypal. He pushed the idea in our field to conceptualize schizophrenia as a mostly genetic disorder instead of being related to childhood experiences. So you remember we had Kraepelin who introduced the idea in the 1910s, 1920s, and was trying to popularize it back then, but still wasn't the dominant idea. And if I remember right, Paul Meehl, when he became elected president of the APA, one of the very first lectures that he gave, if not the very first one that he gave to his fellow APA members, was putting forth the idea that schizophrenia was mostly a genetic disorder rather than being related to, say, the Oedipus complex or something. And he actually theorized that schizophrenia was caused by a single gene called the schizogene or schizogene. And this schizogene would result in a defect in the brain or what he called schizotaxia. So this idea would later be debunked that a single gene would be responsible for schizophrenia. You know, back then when genetic research was in its infancy, there was this simplistic notion that a lot of human difference would be attributed to one gene. Of course, we now know that most of the human difference, you know, that we have has to do with a lot of genes and, of course, involve all the different elements of biology, you have epigenetics and blah, blah, blah. And so it's a complicated thing. It's not just one gene. But he was in line with today's understanding that he was suggesting it was genetic. He just didn't know the extent of the complicated nature of that genetic difference. You know, he thought that about 10% of the population had schizotaxia or this schizogene, which is interesting. It was a revolutionary idea and is still pretty out there, but I think valid. Basically saying about 10% of the population has the genetic possibility of developing schizotypal or schizophrenia. And only some of those people, about half of those people, I don't know exactly what rate, I couldn't find information on how many of those, you know, 1 in 10 people would develop schizotypal, but you could argue maybe it's about half because that is about in line with the prevalence. You know, you have 3, 4, 5% of the population would qualify for schizotypal. So you take 10% that have the potential, you take half of those people that have schizotypal, and then he thought 10% of those people would develop full-blown schizophrenia, which mathematically works out to be about 1% of the population would have schizophrenia, which is the lifetime prevalence rate that we find. So, you know, he was right about a lot of things. And he also basically was introducing this idea of spectrum, right? Or really trying to popularize it, or trying to, highlight it. Instead of thinking of schizophrenia and other kinds of issues in the DSM as this black and white thing, which we still suffer from today, this notion that's like, you either have schizophrenia or you don't. You either have PTSD or you don't. You either have depression or you don't. And we all understand, I hope, that these things are on a spectrum, and someone could be just below diagnosable threshold, a diagnosable threshold, like they're almost diagnosable with depression, but not entirely. And so you wouldn't say that person has zero depression. You would just say that they're, they're subclinical, but they still have a lot of traits of depression. And even if you have depression, there are varying degrees of depression. So we want to think about things on a spectrum. And so, you know, he was trying to put forth that idea, and also popularizing the idea that, you know, you have a lot of people walking around in society that are functioning well, and they might have one or two interesting traits, maybe some pros and cons to those schizophrenia mild symptoms, right? Even sub-schizotypal, right? Anyway. Another notable figure in history regarding schizotypal is Hans Eysenck, who was a German psychologist. He was a very problematic individual, which I'll get into a second. But before we woke up and realized how problematic he was very important in the development of understanding of a variety of things, including schizotypal. Incidentally, in the 1930s, he emigrated to Great Britain to get away from Nazi persecution of Jewish people. His grandmother was Jewish, and the grandmother, actually would later be murdered in a concentration camp. So he, along with a lot of other people in our field, fled in the 1930s from the Nazis throughout Central Europe to Great Britain and the United States, and Freud included, by the way. And so Hans Eysenck was one of those individuals. And he's one of the most cited researchers, if not the most cited researcher in our field. He became influential in the study of personality in general, including schizophrenia and schizotypal. He saw psychosis as being on a spectrum, as other people were starting to talk about at the time, and that everyone was on this spectrum of schizotypy. Later, again, as I said, we figured out that he was highly problematic. For example, and it's just, the list goes on and on. Because he was so respected and so prolific and so cited as a researcher and author, his problematic notions spread far and wide. For example, he thought that people of color were inherently less intelligent, and his work, his respect in our field and his research was used by racist politicians in Britain to discriminate against non-white children in schools. So obviously it's pretty destructive. And then the trickle down effects of that policy, racist policy, propped up by a racist, psychiatric, psychological notion. You know, then the kids who aren't getting as good of an education, and of course, they don't have the opportunities, and da 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 da. Another example, in some of his research, he seemingly fabricated his data. I mean, yikes. Another example, he was paid by the tobacco industry to conduct research, and his research found that there wasn't any evidence that tobacco caused cancer. And according to him, cancer was caused by what he called, or something akin to, a cancer-prone personality. So he thought that the cancer, of the people who smoke cigarettes who develop cancer, it's not the tobacco industry's fault, it's the person's fault, because their personality was such that it made them prone or made them to develop cancer, which of course we all understand today would be ridiculous. You know, are there personality traits that are associated with medical conditions? Yeah. But to think that that's a, even a notable factor in the development or the connection between tobacco smoking and cancer is, of course, ridiculous and very self-serving to the tobacco industry, who gave Hans, I think, you know, a lot of money to essentially get him to side with evil. So, yeah, it's a lot of his work has been retracted. I think there's still efforts to try to retract his research, you know, journals who will make a public statement and say, we are now retracting this paper from our publication, even though it was published 70 years ago or 50 years ago. So yeah, Hans Eysenck, a highly problematic individual in a variety of ways. I'm just giving you the highlights, the sort of topic sentence of how problematic he was as a human being and as a person in our field. Another notable arena in which the notions of schizophrenia that we know today emerged out of at the time in the 40s, 50s, and 60s was the field of family therapy. Family therapy, you could argue, was basically invented as a way of treating families with a member with schizophrenia. And now there were things that predated this time of what I'm calling the beginning of family therapy. For example, you had women social workers in the Northeast United States, even in the late 1800s, that when I read what they were doing and their thoughts on what was happening, these women social workers in the Northeast United States talk very much like family therapists do. But because they're women, I think they're not often looked to as the founders of family therapy. So there's that. Also, you had Nathan Ackerman in the 1930s, and there were other figures that predated this. But if we really want to look to when family therapy became a thing in our field, we would look at a lot of figures in this time that were, you know, starting the field of family therapy. But one is Murray Bowen, which I talk about often. If you ever hear me talk about triangulation or differentiation, Murray Bowen coined and developed these terms, invented them, really. He started Murray Bowen as a Freudian psychiatrist, which is what most individuals in our field started out as, and he specialized in schizophrenia in the 1940s. Along with others at the time, he wasn't happy with the dogma of Freud and psychoanalysis, and similar to a lot of others at the time who were breaking away from Freud, they basically had to start over from scratch. You know, they'd been taught psychoanalysis, had been supervised around it, had practiced it, and then they thought, I don't know, let's look again at this whole thing called the human condition. And since there wasn't a lot of guidance or alternative ideas, a lot of our current ideas of personality and psychotherapy emerged in this time from individuals who were just like, okay, I'm going to throw out psychoanalysis, I'm going to start over. And so what he did, Murray Bowen, is he started to observe people really quite closely. And if I, without... He just wanted to watch them and not be influenced by any other learning, book learning that he had learned at the time. And I think he was a part of a pretty major project treating schizophrenia and had a lot of funding because of that, you know, 40s, 50s, and 60s. And what he found was that a lot of family interactions had an effect on the symptoms. And he and others hypothesized that schizophrenia was caused by the family, not by genetics and not by any kind of Freudian notion, but that the family, the interactions in the family, was the cause and the sustainer of schizophrenia. And it turns out that they were only sort of correct, you know, meaning that family stress and interactions can both exacerbate symptoms that are current. You know, like if you have someone with schizophrenia and they are under stress from the family, then that will not only lead to more stress and thus more symptoms and, you know, in all likelihood, but also it can lead to the individual having a harder time being medication compliant or treatment compliant. They might also start turning to substances as a way of coping with their family, which can exacerbate symptoms, that kind of thing. Also, when they have a symptom, if they're isolated from their family because they're trying to get away from a bad family, the symptoms can cause a lot more problems because there's less of a safety net of a family around them. Also, we know, seemingly, because it's associated, that early childhood trauma, i.e. in a family, can bring about the, you know, can bring about schizophrenia. if you have the genetic disposition plus the family interactions and the traumas. But this notion that family interactions are the sole genesis of schizophrenia is not the consensus today, of course. But because of this early research and because of this early guess or hypothesis, what it put on the map in our field was this idea that families can cause mental issues. And it turns out they weren't right about schizophrenia, but they were right about a lot of other things, you know, which I get into in all the systems talk and also early childhood trauma. So these ideas from Murray Bowen and colleagues were also important in our furthering of understanding of schizophrenia throughout this period of time. Like I was saying earlier, there was a lot of research and a lot of authors writing about schizophrenia and what we would now call schizotypal at the time, and some other labels that were being bandied about because, you know, it's an organic field, meaning that the terms that we have, it's not like they come from us from mountain on high. You know, these are terms that we just invent. One of us will invent them and then one will become popular and the other one will not, you know. For example, I kind of wish that back in this time they delineated between what I'm calling the personality version and the schizophrenia version. So I think we're still kind of living with that legacy. Plus, the word schizotypal sounds so similar to schizophrenia. And I think that it aligns schizotypal too close to schizophrenia, in my opinion. But anyway, so other terms at the time that we no longer use are borderline schizophrenia, which was not borderline personality disorder, but actually what we would call schizotypal today. Now, incidentally, also borderline personality disorder, the origin of that word borderline was a different author using the word borderline in a different way. They were actually referring to borderline. They were referring to people with attachment, abandonment, betrayal traumas. So there was another, you know, you could, so, and the reason why they had that term borderline personality disorder was because they observed these individuals having borderline delusions, because they would have a client who was absolutely sure that in the last session, you know, for example, in the last session, you know, psychoanalyst or you therapist, you said the following thing about me that was very negative about me. And I remember you saying that and I feel totally betrayed and I'm upset at you and I can't believe you said that. And the clinician is going, I did not say that last time. Or, you know, some other kind of distortion that the borderline individual is exhibiting. And so they thought, is this a delusion? Because they firmly believed that this betrayal or this abandonment happened, even from me, and I was there, and I, of course, those things didn't happen. And so they started to wonder, is this schizophrenia? And then they started calling it borderline, and then it eventually just became borderline. But we also had people who were schizotypal, who were, you know, it's a very different version of this borderline delusion, right? But they also called it borderline schizophrenia. So, you know, just kind of interesting. Also, ambulatory schizophrenia was also used for people with schizotypal, meaning that the patient with schizophrenia-like symptoms was mobile instead of being confined to a hospital. So they called them ambulatory schizophrenia sufferers, which is, I don't know, just kind of interesting. And assumes that everyone with schizophrenia is what? Not ambulatory and not out and about. Also, another term that I think still is used in literature is latent schizophrenia, meaning that the schizophrenia is lying in wait. And I kind of wish that that might be a good term to differentiate. Instead of mild schizophrenia, we might call it latent schizophrenia, and then we could maybe call schizotypal personality disorder. Whenever I think about renaming all the personalities, because, you know, we have this legacy that goes back 100 years, sometimes more than that, in terms of our lingo, like borderline personality disorder, it doesn't make any sense. Borderline, it doesn't, it's not intuitive. You have to know the history as to why it's called that. So, for example, borderline personality disorder, we now understand it's not borderline schizophrenia. So why are we still calling it borderline? It doesn't make any sense. We should update our terminology, right? Schizotypal, in my book, should be delineated between mild or latent schizophrenia and something else. And like with borderline, I remember I think I was thinking we should come up with a term like abandonment assumption or a distorted abandonment personality disorder, you know, something that makes more sense within the title, right? So when it comes to schizotypal, what do we call it? You know, what kind of simple, dumbed down version that would be more intuitive? And to me, let me just brainstorm right now. I mean, the core of schizotypal is this magical thinking and suspiciousness. So we could call it, what do we call it? Anyone have an idea? Because it's hard. You got to work in both of those things, right? You got to work in the perceptual distortions and also the paranoia and the suspiciousness. So you call it magical thinking, suspiciousness, personality disorder. Oh, it's so dumb. Or maybe like some kind of combination, you know, like magisuspic something. Anyway, there's a lot of debate prior to 1980 about what to call this mild version of schizophrenia, borderline schizophrenia, ambulatory schizophrenia, latent schizophrenia, schizotypy, schizotype, or just mild schizophrenia. And then in 1980, the DSM-3 was published, and for the past few years, the American Psychiatric Association was debating all this and trying to figure it out. And I don't know why, but they landed on schizotypal. And they also labeled it a personality disorder, which I find to be kind of interesting, because they could have easily just called it schizotypal disorder or schizotype disorder, schizotypy disorder. But they decided on making it a personality disorder, which in my book screwed everything up, because they should have had two labels, which I've already been over. Anyway, 1990s and beyond, lots of research, a ton of research starting in the 90s through the aughts, through the 10s and to today. Lots of research, lots of discussions by thousands of scientists and clinicians. The last 30 years, we've just had an explosion of research and authors. Okay, well, let's end chapter 4 there. And next time on chapter 5, which should be the last chapter, I'll talk about treatment and your emails and other things. And everyone, please take care of yourself, because you deserve it. You really, really do.